Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club, where Michael Kirby makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. The Honourable Michael Kirby spoke for us last, when he was on the Appeals Court in New South Wales. Educated at Fort Street Boys High, where they taught good grammar, as I recall, and at Sydney University did Arts, LLM and Bachelor of Economics, and of course Michael Kirby's had numerous important positions, honours, publications, etc. But I guess he's best known for the period between 1996 and 2009, where he was a Justice of the High Court, including sometimes as Acting Chief Justice of the High Court. But tonight, the Honourable Michael Kirby is here in his capacity as the author of the United Nations Human Rights Report on North Korea, a very important report. And the topic for his talk tonight at the Sydney Institute is Human Rights and North Korea. Michael Kirby, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and thank you all for coming to hear about a faraway country about which we know comparatively little, but which is a place of great wrongs about which we as human beings and citizens of Australia should be deeply concerned. I am also very glad that I'm back with the Sydney Institute, and I applaud the fact that these programs are now being televised. I caught recently, I think two nights ago, the program of Babette Smith, who was here launching her very interesting book on convict days in the early Australian settlements. And I thought it was wonderful that the magnificent work that Gerard and Anne do for the world of intellect in our country is now brought by the means of television to such a big audience, not only in Australia but beyond. Last week, the world was very much focused on the MH17 disaster, and that took us all, if we were watching the television, into the very dramatic consideration of that horrible event in the Security Council of the United Nations. And we saw at work not only our Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, who has done such a fine job as the Foreign Minister of Australia and as the representative of Australia in the Security Council when she is present, but also Ambassador Gary Quinlan and Deputy Head of Mission Philippa King. And I'm glad to acknowledge Mrs. King, her mother, who is here today. They are a formidable team, and I know this because on the 17th of April 2014, it was my responsibility to have a meeting with members of the Security Council concerning North Korea. And I'll come to that in the logical and chronological way, but I want to say that I hope, and in my more optimistic moments, I am expecting that the same spirit of determination to face a grave attack on human life and human rights and human dignity that we saw in the Security Council last week will be brought to bear when ultimately, later in this year, the report of the Commission of Inquiry on North Korea, the COI, is brought to the attention of that world body. The COI was established in May 2013, It was established exceptionally without a vote. Normally, when you set up a body at the level of the COI to investigate a country's human rights, it is bitterly contested in the Human Rights Council. The vote is called, and the countries of the world divide. But that didn't happen in the case of North Korea. I don't know, but I believe that that probably occurred because of the fact that shortly before May 2013, North Korea had gone through its first process of universal periodic review. This is the new procedure that has been introduced as the Human Rights Commission was replaced by the Human Rights Council. And it means that every country, those that are mainly human rights observant, such as Australia, and those that are frequently human rights unobservant, such as North Korea, has to go in a regular routine way through examination by the Secretariat, provided by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and by the Human Rights Council, 45 members elected from the members of the General Assembly of the United Nations, representing the nation states of the whole world. North Korea remains the only country in the world which has undertaken the Universal Periodic Review, which has not accepted a single one of the recommendations that were made to it for improvement of its human rights situation. More than 180 such recommendations were made, and the officials from the government of DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, refused to accept a single one. And I think the international community has, by actions of this kind, and by some of the other actions, including the possession and development of a nuclear arsenal, now got the measure of DPRK, and that the nation states of the world on the whole were fed up. And so the resolution for the establishment of the COI was before the chair, and the chair, who was the ambassador for Poland, thrice asked if there was a call for a vote, and there was none, and so it passed without a vote. It passed nem con. No one expressed disagreement with the establishment of the Commission of Inquiry, which I liked to think gave us an authority that extended beyond that of most COIs, because the whole world community, in effect, said they wanted an inquiry. Two other persons were named to be commissioners. One was Marzuki Darusman, the former Attorney General of Indonesia, and the other was Sonia Biserko, who was a human rights expert from Serbia, who had played quite an important part in the investigations of the genocide that occurred in the closing days of Yugoslavia, and who had strong links with civil society in that country. The three of us met for the first time on the 1st of July 2013 in the magnificent building in Geneva on the lake known as the Palais Wilson. It's named, of course, after Woodrow Wilson, and there is a large plaque in the big vestibule to honour that American president who had endeavoured to create a new world order and to establish the League of Nations, which originally met in the building before it moved across the town up into the big Palais des Nations, where now the United Nations, its successor, meets. The first thing we addressed was methodology. We didn't expect to be allowed into North Korea. Marzuki Darusman is the special rapporteur on the human rights situation in North Korea, and he and his predecessor, Professor Witit Munterborn, who was is a professor of law from Thailand, had repeatedly sought access to North Korea but been refused. We didn't expect that it would be different in our case, because the ambassador in Geneva had indicated that North Korea regarded the creation of the COI as the act of its hostile enemies who were seeking regime change and who were out of sympathy with its brave social experiment to create a socialist country in the midst of many powerful adversaries. When we considered our methodology, an important question was presented to us, and in a sense it was presented because of my background in the common law system inherited from England. Different from the civil law systems, the common law countries normally conduct important investigations in public. Most countries of the world are civil law countries, Indonesia having its legal system derived from the Netherlands, and Serbia having its legal system likewise derived ultimately from the French, is a civilian law country. The tradition of the United Nations is mainly civilian, and that means that inquiries are normally conducted privately, behind closed doors, efficiently, face-to-face with witnesses, then a report is written and that's it. The common law of England has always attached great importance to transparency. That's why the judges always sat in the open, with very, very few exceptions provided by law and very rarely granted by courts, so that the judges can themselves be judged as they perform their duty. We were not judges on this commission, but we were conducting a very serious investigation. We were not prosecutors. We were not a tribunal. We were an investigatory branch whose obligation was to collect the testimony that might lead to conclusions and recommendations and ultimately, possibly, to rendering accountable those who were found responsible for serious human rights violations. And so we agreed to proceed in a different way from COIs generally. We agreed to conduct public hearings. And so we did in Seoul, in the Republic of Korea, in Tokyo, in London, and in Washington, D.C. North Korea adhered to its refusal to allow us access. They were perfectly polite about things. Their ambassador wrote quite polite letters, but the bottom line was we would not be allowed in, and there would be no cooperation. And so we had to proceed in this transparent way in order to meet what we knew would be criticism of the investigation on the self-serving basis that because they had not allowed us in, therefore anything that we wrote was unreliable. And we had to overcome that hurdle. We had no trouble whatsoever getting witnesses. There are 26,000 refugees from North Korea living in the Republic of Korea, South Korea. Large numbers came forward to give testimony. Of those numbers, our secretariat selected, with our agreement and according to our protocol, 240, and we saw 80 of them in public in the four centres that I've mentioned. The public testimony was televised. Some steps were taken to disguise faces and appearances. Care was taken not to ask questions that might lead to the identification of family members still in DPRK. But it was very interesting to us to see the determination with which the witnesses who came before us faced the obligation to give evidence. If any of you have been, as I'm sure many have, to Holocaust museums, you will know what I'm talking about. The people on the video films captured before it is too late, telling their stories of unimaginable wrongs through which they have gone, and telling it in a very matter-of-fact way, a rather low-key way, not aggrandizing themselves, but as if they have an obligation within them to get their story out, both to record the wrongs that have been done to them, and also, in a sense, to justify their survival and to provide testimony that will speak of those who have not survived. And any of you who are interested can Google Commission of Inquiry on North Korea, and you can go straight to the testimony of these witnesses, and you can sit, as we did, as the commissioners did, hour after hour, receiving this testimony of the most horrible wrongs. The testimony was mainly extracted by me. Extracted is really the wrong word, because the technique that I use was the technique which we call examination in chief. I ask non-leading questions. I simply asked questions like, and what happened then? And what did you see then? So that the testimony could come out of the mouth of the witness and not be planted in their mouth by the interrogator. The testimony was addressed to the mandate of the Commission of Inquiry. The mandate addressed 9 subject headings which had been of concern to the Human Rights Council. The existence of places of detention, political detention, and the conditions in those places. Capacity to get information about the country, about the world, the freedom of information and the media, the capacity to move within North Korea and beyond North Korea, discrimination against particular groups, discrimination against women, which we found to be rife in North Korea, discrimination against people of religion, discrimination against people on the basis of their songbun. The songbun is a sort of caste system which was invented by Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea. It categorizes the whole community into 50 classifications. The 50 are essentially grouped in 3 major classifications. The core classes, they are the elite. The wavering classes, they are those who are peaceful but not reliable. And the hostile classes, they are people who are enemies of the regime and of the people. And so the questions were addressed to the discrimination against people on that footing. The issue of food was one of the major headings in the mandate. The Commission of Inquiry found that at least 1 million and possibly closer to 2 million people in North Korea perished in a great famine that swept the country from 1995-6 and lasted for more than 5 or 6 years. The food situation is still very grave in North Korea. 27% of infants born in North Korea are stunted. Stunted is a technical expression which designates a child which is grossly underweight when born. Children who are grossly underweight and are stunted suffer the problem of not having nutrition at the very moment when the human brain is marvellously expanding and when it needs all the nutriment it can get. So this is a long-term health problem that's going to lead to very grave consequences for the people of North Korea, dementia, Alzheimer's, and other health risks. Another issue was the issue of abductees. North Korea had policies for seizing people who it or its agents considered would be helpful to the regime. This was first widely practiced at the end, towards the end of the Korean War, 1951-53. At the end of that war, as the North Korean forces were being driven out of South Korea, north, by the United Nations forces under General MacArthur, they grabbed large numbers, 100,000 was the smallest estimate, of South Koreans who they thought would be useful. Though the armistice required that they return prisoners of war, they underestimated grossly the numbers of prisoners of war, a factor which was revealed in the archives of the Soviet Union, which produced the record of the conversations between Kim Il-sung and Stalin. More recently, agents of North Korea have seized a number of Japanese nationals. They've arrived in Japan in fishing boats disguised as Japanese fishing boats. Agents have then moved into Japan and seized particular or even just random people who have been taken to North Korea for various not entirely clear reasons. Some of them appearing to be in order to secure the idiom of the Japanese language so that they could send spies into Japan who would be up to date with Japanese popular idiom. One such person was a young girl, Magumi Yokota, who was on her way home from badminton, her parents expecting her at 7:30, but Magumi never arrived, and she ultimately died in Japan. Some bones were sent back to Japan, but when analysed, they were found to be the DNA of a dog. And most recently, the regime did allow the mother of Magumi to meet in Mongolia a daughter of Magumi, who had been born in North Korea. This is a sort of tapestry of the barbaric and cruel acts that we found in our investigation. As I listened to one witness who described how his job was in the detention camp to pick up the bodies of those who had died, mainly from lack of food during the day, to wheel them to a vat, to put them in a vat, to light the vat, subsequently to come back to collect the ashes and the body parts, the legs and extremities that had not burned. And his job then was to wheel those ashes and body parts to the nearby fields to act as fertilizer. As I saw in my mind's eye the evidence of this witness, it reminded me powerfully of those black and white movie tone newsreels that I saw in my youth when I was 8 or 9 or 10, of General Eisenhower and General Montgomery arriving at some of the concentration camps in Germany and seeing the terrible conditions of the people, the prisoners, the lack of food, the skeletal conditions, and seeing the way in which their bodies were disposed of. I've seen in one blog a person saying, why do people of the left always refer to the Nazis and not to Stalin? Well, let me be clear, I don't like to be classified, and I only refer to that image because it's very fresh in my mind and it seemed very similar. I haven't seen images of a similar kind of Stalin's gulags, but I'm sure they were very similar too. And international universal human rights doesn't discriminate on left-right trivial grounds. It operates on the principle that we are all, as human beings, entitled to basic dignity and to respect for our fundamental universal human rights. And tyrants are tyrants, and whether they are Stalin or Hitler or Kim Il-sung, they deserve the denunciation of the international community. Now, the report of the Commission had to be written quickly because it had to be delivered by March 2014. That meant that we had to effectively get it written by the end of 2013 so that it would have time to be translated into the five additional languages of the United Nations. And that is what we did. We reached unanimous agreement, not only on the methodology, but on our conclusions, on all of the matters in our mandate. We wrote our report. I took great pains with the report. I did that because it's been my melancholy duty over the years to read some UN reports and not to put too fine a point on it. They are often unreadable, possibly because they've been written by people whose first language is not the language in which they're written, and they have a certain artificiality. But there's a lot of passive voice in them, and it's very structured and very difficult to read. So we set ourselves the goal to make our report readable. And on every second page of our report are extracts from the witnesses who gave testimony. This allows the victims to speak very directly to the United Nations and to the world and to you. The report is most readable and I suggest vivid and powerful as a communicative device because of the fact that it has these extracts from the witnesses. North Korea said that the witnesses, were human scum, that they were a self-appointed and self-designated group of people who were hostile to the regime. But it was actually quite interesting, as you listened to many of them, that they would slip in that they rather liked, in some cases saying they loved Kim Il-sung. They didn't feel the same way about his successes, but they regarded him as the father of the nation, and he was the originator and founder of their state. That was telling for us, because if you were simply hostile to North Korea and didn't think there was anything good about the place, you wouldn't be going around saying that you really admired Kim Il-sung, but this, their witnesses did. The report was delivered to the Human Rights Council on the 17th of March, St. Patrick's Day. Very strong statement by the ambassador for Ireland on that day, and I acknowledged the strength of her statement about universal human rights on that day. There were very strong statements by most of the countries present, and in the end, a resolution condemning North Korea and calling for urgent action along the lines of our report was adopted, with only six countries voting against, 6 out of 45. That is an unusually strong resolution. The Russian Federation, China, Venezuela, Cuba, Vietnam, and Pakistan. They were the countries that were not persuaded by our report. The report then exceptionally, once again, was called forward to the members of the Security Council with the initiative of France. A so-called ARIA procedure was invoked. Mr. ARIA was a Uruguayan diplomat who devised a procedure which was designed to allow matters to come before members of the Security Council without going across the hurdle of the veto. Not as a formal process of the Security Council, but in order to give a briefing. And so we were called forward to New York on the 17th of April 2014, and that's where I saw Gary Quinlan, the ambassador, and Philippa King, and the whole team of the Australian mission to the Security Council, we being providentially a non-permanent member of the Security Council at the moment. I saw them working to get a consensus in the international community. France was the originator, but Australia and the United States of America joined in the proposal for the ARIA process, and it took place. And again, there were extremely powerful statements, but there were two chairs that were empty. The chair of China, the chair of the Russian Federation. So some people have said to me, realism requires you to appreciate that nothing is going to come out of your report, that nothing will be done, that two of the P5, permanent five members of the Security Council, will veto any action. I'm not so sure, and watching what happened last week, I'm more inclined than I was before to believe that the process of the Charter, which establishes the United Nations and the Security Council, can operate even in very vexed circumstances where there are very strong differences of opinion. So I'm hopeful that that's going to happen again in the case of North Korea. What will happen now is that the report of the COI will be delivered to the General Assembly from the Human Rights Council in September 2014. And I hope that then, as we have recommended, that the report will be referred by the General Assembly to the Security Council. The Security Council has responsibilities for peace and security, one of the three foundational goals and objectives of the United Nations: peace and security, universal human rights, and international justice. The last has led to the decolonization process of the Trusteeship Council, and also to the endeavours to improve the economic situation of countries, but they are the three pillars of the United Nations. And just as was envisaged when the organisation was founded by President Roosevelt and subsequently President Truman, and with the strong participation of Dr. Evatt from Australia and successive politicians from Australia, my hope is that the Council will operate correctly. There is a resolution before the Security Council already. It regularly comes back to the Security Council, and it's concerned with the nuclear weapons of North Korea. North Korea, though having a population almost identical to Australia, about 23 million, North Korea has the fourth largest standing army in the world. It also has a nuclear arsenal, estimated to be 20 nuclear warheads, and it has developed and is still developing missiles with delivery capacity, certainly to South Korea, which is only 100 kilometres away, also to Japan, and also with a range to enter into China and to other countries. And their effort at the moment is to develop an arsenal that, with a nuclear capacity, that will reach the United States of America, so that it is a dangerous country. The resolution of the Security Council comes regularly back to the Council on North Korea, and that gives a way by which, with appropriate international consensus, the matter can be examined by not a new resolution on North Korea, but by some amendment of the resolution that brings North Korea already under the scrutiny of the Security Council. Some intervention of the Security Council may be necessary if one of the key recommendations we made is to be followed up. And that was the recommendation that the Security Council exceptionally should refer the question of North Korea to the International Criminal Court. That court, established in The Hague under the Rome Statute, gets jurisdiction either in respect of countries that ratify the Rome Statute, and North Korea has not done that, or exceptionally if the Security Council refers the matter to it. And so I'm hoping that that eventually that will be done. But if it isn't done, there are two things that should be remembered. One is that it will always be possible for the United Nations to continue the task of securing and recording the testimony of the witnesses who will come forward, just as they did to us. And the United Nations has now established in ROK, the South Korea, a field office for that purpose, to gather the testimony of people and to continue the process which the Commission of Inquiry began. Secondly, it was interesting for all of us who were serving on the COI, the Secretariat and the Commissioners, to witness the response of the nation states sitting around the table in Geneva and in New York. So many of the ambassadors or staff members from countries like Albania, Poland, the Czech Republic, and Kazakhstan came up to us and said, please do not think that if no action follows immediately from your report that you have wasted your time. We know what you're writing about. We went through similar experiences. They weren't as bad as the record that you have produced to us, but we understand it. We know all this. And what you have done is exactly what the United Nations ought to do in this situation. And in due course of time, when the cloud is lifted from the people of Korea, they will know that in such a dark time, the United Nations, through its appropriate organs, took steps, was concerned about their condition, was determined to investigate it and to continue the effort to bring those who are guilty of great wrongs to accountability. And as a person who has worked on a number of projects for the United Nations and who knows how maddeningly inefficient it can sometimes be, I have to tell you that this is an occasion, the report of the Commission of Inquiry on North Korea, where the United Nations has done everything that it should have done. Everything has been done in the most appropriate way. The support from the highest to the lowest offices of the organisation have been given, and I do not believe that this will be a waste of time. I believe that it will lead to accountability, and that that is our responsibility under the Charter of the United Nations. So thank you all very much, and now we have some time for Q&A. I'm getting used to Q&A now.
So, the Honourable Michael Kirby, many thanks for a moving address here tonight. I should say thanks to the Gallipoli Club for the use of this facilities, and the bars and the restaurants are still open when we conclude no later than 7 o'clock. There are a lot of people here today, tonight, so I ask you to keep your comments or your questions fairly brief. If I repeat them, it's not because they're incoherent, it's because I want them picked up by our pods up the front, which a lot of our members listen to outside of Sydney. And so we start. I think there was a report within the last week of some discussions between the Japanese and the North Koreans about the kidnapped Japanese personnel of, I think, what, about 30 years ago. Would that indicate anything about the current attitude in the North Vietnamese administration, or is that something that the North Koreans occasionally do to keep the debate quietened down? Or how do you read that?
Well, that's a good question, Jared. One can't be absolutely sure. The meeting took place in secret, though it was subsequently acknowledged. The Japanese had previously sent a prime minister, Mr. Koizumi, to North Korea. It was at that occasion, Kim Jong-il was then the supreme leader, when the acknowledgement was made that North Korea had seized Japanese nationals. And far from quieting Japanese concerns. That outraged the Japanese nation that a state policy of seizure had taken place. Mr. Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, has set as a strong political agenda bringing home the people from North Korea, the Japanese nationals who are still there or their remains, so that they can be honoured appropriately in Japan. There is a question as to how many persons are affected. Mr. Abe has suggested that it's 17, but the Commission of Inquiry thought it was more likely to be a figure of about 100. And civil society organisations often contend that it's many hundreds of Japanese nationals, so sometimes anybody who goes disappears is put down as having been seized, and you can't always accept that is what has happened. As to the politics of the relationship between Japan and North Korea, North Korea wants the legitimacy of finishing the strong dispute over what it would see as comparatively small numbers of people. Small numbers when you think that 120,000 are in the detention camps, that a million at least have been starved to death, and that the very large numbers of people have suffered all the other wrongs. But I think it might be distraction, or it might be a genuine attempt to so resolve their dispute with Japan that they can get some much-needed foreign aid and resources from Japan. But I myself don't see that happening unless the security issue is resolved, because it's very much alive in the minds of Japanese citizens that there are these 20 nuclear warheads and increasingly sophisticated missile delivery systems.
There's a question right down the back, then we go over there. Yes.
Your Honour, has the report of the Committee of Inquiry yet been tabled either in the Australian Parliament or any other national legislature?
Has the report of the Committee been tabled in the Australian Parliament or any other legislature?
It certainly has been referred to in the Australian Parliament, and there is no party difference over this issue. There is strong support for the work of the Commission of Inquiry, and throughout our work, I drew attention to every step along the way, both to the foreign minister and to the shadow foreign minister, and also to the minority parties. I believe that the report has been tabled in the Congress of the United States. Supporting statements have certainly been made in the Australian Parliament. One object that I have is to try to get the report printed. It is available online, free of charge, and that's a good thing. But being an old-fashioned type of person, I like to see a book. And of course there is, in the case of North Korea, there is a whole library of material on North Korea. North Korea is an endless source of fascination for people. And all too often they present it as if it's a sort of slightly amusing place with a cuddlesome leader with a bad haircut and peculiar friends, and people giggle and laugh about it. But if you read the report of the Commission of Inquiry, this is not a laughing matter. This is a very grave, sustained and wicked affront to the human rights of millions of people on the Korean Peninsula, and it has to be stopped, and people responsible have to be rendered accountable.
So the prospect of getting a printed edition, good or not?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you have such enormous power. You might be able to find some publishing house that would be willing to publish it. But
I'm sure there would be, but it's not a lot of money, really, when you think of it.
It's about 300 pages, 350 pages of typescript, and it really ought to be available. Even if I say so myself, it's a very easy read. Every word has been weighed, and there is no passive voice. It is written in the active voice of the people who give the testimony, and that brings it to life. On every page or second page, there's something where somebody tells their little story about the great wrongs that they've suffered, the prisoners who've lived on grass and rodents, I was reading a book last week in Europe about the Jews of the Netherlands sent out of Germany, out of the Netherlands, and how they also had to live on grass in the concentration camp. So this is a formula, and it's a formula that is no more tolerable by the passing of the years.
There's a question down there. Yes.
Given North Korea's dependence on China for food and other aid, many people in the West place their hope for regime change on convincing China to abandon their support. Do you believe that China's influence in North Korea is overstated? And if so, what's our best hope for regime change in that scenario?
Question about China's influence over North Korea.
I think China is the key to action. And in that respect, it's very important for us to understand that since the PRC acquired the China seat in the United Nations, it has only exercised the so-called right to veto 10 times, including a week or so ago on the Syria resolution. China does not use the veto very often. It's not the Chinese way of doing things. And that, I think, is an important feature in getting some action in the Security Council. Now, what is China's influence in North Korea? I think China does have influence, but maybe it's not as much as China would wish. One reads of the fact that China itself is exasperated with the situation in North Korea. And being a neighbour and with a common boundary, a border, it must be concerned about the security issues that are presented. The fact that the second or third most powerful person in the land, Jang Song-taek, the uncle of this present supreme leader, was grabbed, dragged out of the Politburo under the international television lights, taken to a military tribunal, tried before judges who were reported in the North Korean press to denounce him as a dog and worse than a dog, and executed, all in the space of 4 days, when, as best we can see, his great crime was that he was trying to position North Korea to go down the path similar to that which China has gone down, to retain its regime, but to open it up to a freer market and economic progress. What a way to resolve a political dispute. What a way to resolve it within the family and to destroy one of the most powerful people in the world. A country that does that sort of thing is a very unstable country, and it's a reason why the interconnection between the three principles of the United Nations, peace and security, universal human rights, and international justice, come relevant to this situation. Because if North Korea is such a country with such instability in its leadership, that is a very great danger to China and to everyone else in the region, including Australia.
Question here.
Yes, do you think that perhaps socialist countries and, for example, Nazi Germany, societies that are formed by leaders who have an ideological view, you see in Germany large numbers of people killed in Germany. You notice in socialist countries very large numbers of Russians, Chinese, Pol Pot, etc. Large number of people killed. And in the same in Germany, it was obviously an attempt to get rid of the sort of people you don't want. But is that what happens in socialist countries, that there are whole sections of society you don't want? Or is it just bad agriculture and they have millions starve?
So it's a question about the intention of the rulers of these totalitarian regimes. Do they kill people deliberately, or does it happen because of bad policy?
Well, I'm not in a position to do psychoanalysis of the leaders, and that would certainly be a challenge to anybody, I think, to undertake an analysis. Lying alone or lying in bed at night and thinking of a million of his fellow citizens starving to death, one would hope that any rational human being would say, well, maybe we're on the wrong track. But we all know that people who have power sometimes don't question themselves, and especially if they have totalitarian power. They just have this messianic conviction that they have the right to proceed as they do. You referred to North Korea as a socialist country, and it's sometimes referred to as a communist country, but actually it's a kind of absolute monarchy with a very relatively small elite gathered around a particular family, most of the strategies seem to be directed at preserving that elite and the position of that family as the symbol of that elite. That is a challenge, especially when you hear witnesses who have suffered grievously because of that elite coming forward and saying, well, actually, I rather love Kim Il-sung. It just shows how this is a totalitarian state. A totalitarian state is one where the government is not content with controlling the actions of people. It wants to get into the heads of people and control the way they look at the world and think about the world. But ultimately, I think the new technology, they don't have access to the internet, but they do now have access to an intranet with 2 million estimated handheld mobile phones. And that has become a way whereby people can jump the requirement that they have to get permission to leave their village. They can speak to villages far away. They can mainly find what the market for food is, and that's what it's mainly been used for. But, by the way, it can also allow people to intercommunicate and know what civil society is doing, and that has been the problem. They haven't been able to have this interconnection because of the rigid controls. Children are taken, as we heard, many witnesses told this, and children in schools are taken to watch the public executions to give them the message that anyone who stands up and defies or challenges the regime will suffer a terrible punishment. Even children have to go and watch that.
First, I'm more of a theocracy, but looking forward 10, 15 years, what do you see North Korea looking like? Best case?
Best case scenario, 10 to 15 years looking into the future, what do you think North Korea might be?
Well, everybody asks, how long can this last? How long can the pain continue? Victor Cha, who was one of the staff of President George W. Bush, finishes a recent book he wrote with, if this regime is still in operation in 20 years, I will not be surprised. If this regime has disappeared in 20 years, I will not be surprised. Our job was not to suggest regime change. They often challenged us with that, but that was not our job and not our agenda. We were operating within the United Nations, and they are a member state of the United Nations, and therefore we had to accept that they are a member state, and we had to say, well, if you're a member state, you have to comply with the Charter, and you also have to comply with the Universal Human Rights Instruments, most of which they have signed. Others can suggest regime change. It belongs ultimately to the people under international law, to the people of North Korea. But what we have said is, if you are to be a law observant state of the United Nations system, you have to change in all of these ways. And at the end of our report is a long series of steps that should be taken, including one of them, referral of the case of North Korea to the International Criminal Court. So I'd be hopeful that things will happen. There's no doubt things will happen. This is not rational. But when it will happen and how it will happen, that's not at all certain.
We're getting close to the end now. I've got a question there, one there, and down the back. So, I'll be quick. Yep.
Well, I was going to ask Justice Kirby if he would be able to put a time frame on the accountability that he spoke about. But that was question was
okay.
Partly answered.
All right, so we've missed, so we go there.
Your Honour, as citizens in a free society, we know what the United Nations should do, what the Australian government should do. What can we do as individuals? Is there anything?
Chris, what can individuals do about this apart from United Nations or governments, what can we do?
Well, it's a very good thing that here we are in Sydney, Australia, and a very large audience has come out. It's not only a tribute to Gerard and the many intellectual problems and challenges he places before us in the Sydney Institute, but it's also an indication that Australians are concerned about that, as they rightly should be. What I can do, although I have demitted office and my formal duties are finished, is to continue to bring this matter to the attention of international meetings, and I'm doing that. I've already done it in South Korea, in the United States of America, in Norway, and I'll shortly be going to Hong Kong, where a group have asked for a report there, and in Tokyo there's a big meeting, and in Thailand the Law Asia is meeting. So we've got to keep this before the agenda. There's always a risk that the 24-hour news cycle will shift on and move to new things and people will lose attention. But then I think we can write to our minister, we could write to Julie Bishop and the shadow minister, we could congratulate Julie Bishop for her outstanding work in the last week, and we could suggest that this issue too is a matter of deep concern to Australians and to people of the United Nations everywhere, that we should ensure that this comes back to the Security Council whilst Australia is still a member, and that Australia takes, again, a leading role to put in train the steps which the Commission of Inquiry has suggested, including the step of referring of North Korea to the COI, to the ICC. I mean, we still live in a democracy and we can express our views to our members of Parliament, and I think that's what people should do.
So we'll go right down, we'll take two questions right down the back and then Suzanne for the last question. Yeah. What's your take on the Russian Federation opposition to... What's your take on the Russian Federation position on Korea, North Korea?
Well, we went several times to see the Russian ambassador, and he was extremely polite and courteous. He gave us some advice, which we followed. He said, to the extent that they have done positive things, acknowledge it. And they, in all truth, it's a short list. But they had, for example, ratified, or they'd signed, not yet ratified, the Convention on Disabilities. There was a lot of evidence and documentary as well as oral testimony about how they didn't allow disabled people in Pyongyang. They were removed from the city in order not to offend people with the sight of disabled. Well, that apparently has improved, and so we gave acknowledgement to that and to various other bits and pieces. But he also said, and it's borne out by a lot of data, their trade links with North Korea have almost evaporated. The big links that they had during the Soviet Union time, which were based on the fraternal relationships of their political parties, are not now very significant. He suggested that North Korea is a kind of time warp. It's a kind of relic of an earlier time, and that is historically clearly the fact. So that I don't think the Russian Federation has anything like the interest in what happens in North Korea that China does, but it still has a sense of historical association, and of course at the moment. Russia, I suppose, feels that it needs all the friends it can get.
Briefly, Suzanne.
You're keen to get the confessions of these people and the hearings that the Commission published in a book form, but maybe, as it's all there online, what about taking it to the next step of having it made into a documentary, which will get to far more people?
The proposal is that your report should be become a documentary.
Well, it's a good suggestion, and in fact, there's been a tremendous amount of international media coverage, and it wouldn't be difficult to build a documentary based on selected portions of the testimony of the witnesses. It's very powerful stuff, and I think there are, we made a little documentary to introduce some of the side sessions in Geneva in order to give glimpses of the testimony. We asked the president of the Human Rights Council if we could bring two clips of witness testimony into the Human Rights Council proceedings. And ultimately, he was advised to and refused that request. He said, if we do it for you, it's going to have to be done for all, and that's going to add emotion and so on. In this book I was reading last week by a man named Jacob Presser, which I recommend to you, it's called Ashes in the Wind, and it's about the destruction of the Jewish population of the Netherlands. And it's rather critical, more critical than I've ever seen, of the Netherlands response and of the fact that Netherlands police and others took part in the oppression. But when he sent his manuscript to Kluwer, the international publishing house, he was told, your manuscript is too emotional. He, by the way, was hidden by a Christian family and emerged. He was one of the 10,000 that emerged at the end of the occupation, the war. He was told, your work is too emotional. You must take the emotion out of it and rewrite it, and we'll consider. And he signed off that he would do that. But then he thought about it, and then he thought, how can I speak of the destruction of 110,000 people without emotion? I can't even think of it without emotion. And how can I speak about the destruction of a million Korean people for famine, spending money on nuclear weapons and the fourth largest army in the world, when fellow citizens were dying? Sometimes an element of emotion is required, because it speaks to our human hearts and minds. And I think there's a lot in what Presser... He then published his book privately. It's tremendously powerful, and it has a due amount of emotion. And so when we meet here in the safety of Sydney, Australia, we should reflect that as we meet here, there are people far away in Korea who don't know that we're meeting. They've never heard of the COI. They don't know of the United Nations and its concern about their plight. But it's our duty as human beings and as citizens of a free country to do whatever we can to advance the cause of universal human rights for the people of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
People here tonight, and I'll be very brief. Many thanks to the Honourable Michael Kirby for a wonderful, wonderful speech tonight, which had a lot of empiricism and a lot of facts, but a moving speech and ended with suitable emotion. I think it's terrific that that a country like Australia was asked to, that one of our Australians in a country like Australia was asked to do this important task for the United Nations. It has been a significant report. It is very well written. The bits I've read attribute to Fort Street Boys High, I'm sure. Perhaps not Sydney University.
You're only jealous it wasn't Jesuit.
But it is very well written, and I do hope it does get a publisher. And quite frankly, publishing doesn't, for this amount of pages, doesn't cost a lot. And there should be a publisher somewhere in Australia or overseas who can do this task. And I think that's something we can all do something about. But for tonight, congratulations and well done on the task. Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.